All right, everyone. I think all of you in the audience really badly want to make friends with our next speaker, because if you're planning on dying ever, which granted many people in this audience aren't, he's a good guy to know. He raises the dead for a living. He just told me they've successfully been able to bring people back 12 minutes after, their heart has ceased to beat and other things. That's pretty freaky stuff. He is the professor of emergency medicine and the director of resuscitation science at the University of Pennsylvania. And his last sentence on the program in his bio I needed to read because it was just so brilliant. His ongoing studies include development of novel human coolants for rapid induction of hypothermia, improving the quality of CPR, new defibrillator and cardiopulmonary bypass technologies, and epidemiology of sudden death. Please welcome Dr. Lance Becker to the stage.
Well, good morning to everyone, and let me, I know this is totally undigital, but those of you who have analog devices, I would like a little wave of analog devices. How many people here have actively tried to save somebody's life with their hands, somebody who was dying right in front of them? There you go. So this next talk is for you and for everyone, because that's what I do pretty much every day in the emergency department. I really am basically an emergency room doctor. And I was led to this, and this talk is very much sort of the story of sort of where we are today, but where we could be in just a very few years in terms of our ability to really do some things that we just can't do right now. And so I've sort of titled this Modifying the Boundary Between Life and Death, and I'll tell you a story. That once upon a time, life was really very simple, okay, for those of us who were trained as physicians. You know, people were either alive, okay, or there was something bad that happened and they were dead, okay? And the truth of the matter was there's just a very minute window between those two during which we had the opportunity to resuscitate someone, so to bring them back to life. And that window was so narrow that it really was not expected, all right? And what I want to do is give you the notion that it need not be like that. Let's think about that boundary just a little bit, because when I trained, and really I think that this would be true today, that most students are taught that after about 4 minutes or so, the brain without oxygen will begin to become irreversibly injured. All right? And that is pretty much dogma. And what I want to suggest is why that might not be true and what the implications of that would mean. And so very much what I'll be talking about today is kind of moving that boundary, expanding that boundary zone between life and death. And it's sort of the notion of, well, what, how big is that boundary? How long is that boundary? How do we define what goes on within that boundary? And so that's really what I want to focus on. It's sort of like, what is going on right in here? So what I do in my research is I really examine what goes on in here and try to look deep within it to understand it, and you'll notice that it sort of got these question marks on it, and I think that where we stand today, we understand this very poorly. So what do we know about that? Well, as I mentioned, when I trained, it was 4 minutes, but the question is, well, what would the world be like if it was 10 minutes, or 20 minutes, or 40 minutes? As a period of time in which we had the opportunity to restore a person to full life. And that's sort of the thinking that I do on a very regular basis, and the sort of technology that I think we are very close to achieving. Now, I'm gonna try to not use a lot of medical, heavy medical technology and words in this lecture, but I'm gonna define the conditions I'm talking about. They're conditions that you all have heard about. Sort of the mother of this problem is cardiac arrest, sudden cardiac arrest. Someone who's walking around, their heart goes into a arrhythmia, they have no blood pumping to any of their organs, they collapse immediately, and for the most part, 95 to 98% of those people will not be resuscitated. But there's similar kinds of things with people who lose all their blood, someone who's shot in the heart, children who are deprived of oxygen, poisoning, the organ disasters, as I call them, like strokes and heart attacks and brain death. So what do those diseases, those conditions share that makes this sort of an area of science or an area that we're trying to develop? And what it is this thing that we call ischemia and reperfusion. So ischemia is the loss of normal oxygen or blood flow, and reperfusion is followed by the attempt to restore that oxygen or blood flow. And as you know, I mean, that's really what the bread and butter of what emergency medicine is about. Someone who has been without oxygen, and we provide oxygen, right? I mean, that's what we really do. Well, I want to suggest why that may not be exactly the thing that you always want to do in an uncontrolled way. So what I want to suggest, and the whole focus of this talk, is that this boundary is far more flexible than we think. And what it raises is this really interesting question that none of the other speakers have sort of even mentioned this word thus far, death. Death. Now, we are sort of death phobic for good reason. It's probably evolutionary, I would argue. And when in some of my research, you know, the universities bring in the people who try to get you in front of a donor or something like that, and they said, Lance, could you not say the word death when you talk about what you're doing? Because it's really sort of a bummer when we're trying to, you know, raise money to talk about death. But I'm going to talk about death, and I hope that what I'll do in the next few minutes is change some of your ideas about death and sort of what we know about it. And my argument is really going to be that in order to understand and prolong life, we're going to need to better understand death. Very simple notion. So we need to talk about death, and one of the things that we could talk about is what is death. And certainly at a conference like this, I know nothing about artificial intelligence. I would barely claim to be intelligent, okay? But I know nothing about artificial intelligence. But what I can tell you is this is something that we also know very little about. Surprisingly little about what the actual processes of death really are. So when I became interested in reversing death, I thought I needed to learn about it. And I knew that I couldn't define what death is, so I might be able to show you a little information on when is death. So that was a question that I thought I could answer some years ago. So I went to the laboratory and began to do what I thought would be a very simple and straightforward sort of laboratory experiment. And I'm going to take you to that laboratory experiment. And what at that point, I was growing heart cells. For those of you who haven't had the pleasure of working with heart cells, they're wonderful little guys. You can disaggregate them. They'll grow on a cover slip. And after about a day or so, they all stick down on the cover slip. And they actually begin to beat. So what's wonderful is you end up with a beating layer of cells that you can stick in the microscope and put in a hermetically sealed chamber. And so you can do anything you want to them, and it's a fabulous model to look at. And I thought I would ask a very simple question, which is, when do the cells die? Let's start there. When do cells die? And so if you can imagine, this is cell death on this axis, and here's time going along here, and I was going to do a very naughty thing to those cells, which is to expose them for 60 minutes, for 1 hour, to the lack of oxygen. And what I presumed I would see during that time is that at some point during that time, they would be quite unhealthy and they would begin to die. And then when I restored oxygen, like I do with patients all the time, that death curve would sort of level off. Death by ischemia. There were some really cool guys in London who said, no, you might find something quite different than that, Lance. You might actually find that they do quite well and that you bring back oxygen and they all die right here. Just totally wacky, if you ask me. And, of course, I did that experiment, and here's what we found. And this was what we published, which is that the cells did almost nothing, and I gave back their reperfusate that they had been so happy in 60 minutes before. And look at the effect of that. And of course, you know, as an ER doc, I said, whoa, what am I doing to all my patients, right? Whoa, can we do something right here? So the good news, and I'm not going to go into the biochemistry of this, is that there are now a whole number of interventions that we can actually do right at this point that will alter this death curve. But that's not really the question. There was really a really good question. You know that your best questions when you're an academic are by students, you know. And I had a student who looked at this curve, you know, and he just said, why? Like, why? So let's think about that for just a moment, right? Because here's what I think I was seeing, right? How about this? Would you buy this car? For $75,000, a lot of money. There's just one little quirk. You run out of gas, and then you put gas in the car, and now think about this. So here's the whole cells. We're looking under the microscope. They look happy. The oxygen, we take it, it goes away. We let these cells sit there for an hour. They're all there. They look great. We bring oxygen back, and within literally minutes, this is what you see. Well, that sort of changes your perspective just a little bit in terms of what you do if you're an emergency doctor, right? Where what you do is you immediately restore oxygen to every organ that's without oxygen. So that led me to sort of the first, if you will, very simple conclusion, which is that, and what I need to tell you is that this phenomena doesn't just happen in heart cells. It happens in brain cells. It happens in endothelial cells. It happens in white cells. It happens in liver cells. It happens in kidney cells. It's pretty much universal. So a few cells it doesn't happen to, and you'll get some hints on what cells those might not be. But so I came to this very simplistic notion, and as did many of my colleagues, is that what we were seeing was really intentional death. Death by design. Does everyone understand? This is not cells running out of gas. This is not, it's not like a cell pooped out and it died. That's not what happens. It's a very active process. And so as we began to study this, this intentional death, it led us some places. And of course, that's sort of the fun of the journey. As they say, all roads lead to Rome. And all roads in intentional death lead to this little organelle called the mitochondria. Now, a few of the previous speakers talked a little bit about the mitochondria and provided a very nice little introduction to that. And I want to think about this mitochondria for just a few minutes here. So you've been introduced to the notion that we are eukaryocytic cells. And that it's very likely that a prokaryocytic cell was actually the forerunner to our mitochondria. And this is sort of the size differential. This is what bacteria would look like. And, of course, those are now felt to be the organelles, if you will, that if you will, synergized into our cells to produce our eukaryocytic complexity that we live in. And it's an event that, as far as we know in evolution, has only taken place twice on our planet, once with the mitochondria, once with the chloroplast, and we identify that by the fact that these have their own DNA that still remains in our cells, that our mitochondria contain their own naked DNA. And what many of us now believe is that this is sort of a pretty important event, all right? A pretty important event, and part of the reason that we know it's an important event is that we suspect that this is the event that allowed us to become multicellular. Now, that's kind of an important thing. That's different than evolution, but multicellularity is, if you will, a pretty important thing for organizational putting things together. So as we think about this mitochondria that may have allowed us that, what we all learned when we studied mitochondria is that they were responsible for energy, ATP, but sort of the insight over the last 15 years or so has been that they in fact bring us this intentional death. And so now I want to suggest that in order for that to be true, there must be a switch somewhere inside this organelle that does that. And I want to take you to what we think that switch might be between energy and death. So that requires looking further inside the mitochondria to the part of the mitochondria that actually handles electrons. And that's the electron transport chain. And I show this just as a demonstration of the sort of switching mechanism that we're now trying to understand. And for those of you who use oxygen, you can, okay? This is why you use oxygen. It's to keep your mitochondria happy. And what those mitochondria do is they simply transfer an electron from your food to oxygen, and that is what produces water and respiration. Well, how could that same mechanism, is it possible that same mechanism could be used to produce death? And that's really what we now believe. And that is actually quite a simple thing to do, that when you have the lack of oxygen, what happens is electrons simply pile up into that, sort of like a stuck plumbing system. And your food substrates feed this. This is for those of you who are chemists. This is reduction. You can't really pick up a basic science journal without a redox kinetic paper that's coming out. And that's what that's all about, are these electrons piling up in here. And this is quite abnormal in our mitochondria. They don't normally do that. They only do that when we're without oxygen. And then, of course, what I do as the emergency doctor is I come along and add oxygen. And we now believe that it's this oxygen in the presence of these reduced mitochondria that is the, sort of the lethal combination that signals death. And so that signal is a very strong signal. And it also provides a new target for therapeutics, though. And so there's lots of therapeutics within this slide that we might now begin to look at. And so we're working on things like cocktails and antioxidants to suck up some of these, inhibiting some of this death signaling and cooling, which I'll talk about in a minute, and turning off the mitochondria with various types of inhibitors. So my work is focused on reperfusion cocktails that will not produce death. And in addition, for those of you who design devices, I don't think we're going to be successful at that until we have something called a mitochondrial meter. If anybody has one, come see me, because we lack one right now, and we really need one. So coming back to the border zone and what we can do, all of you know a bit about CPR. That will bring people from the early part of this border zone, and we've made big strides in defibrillation and automatic external defibrillators. We're now... cooling is here in most emergency departments. And we know that all of those things will rescue people from this zone, but what I want to talk about for just a few more minutes is this idea of cardiopulmonary bypass. That's a heart-lung machine coupled to mitochondrial sort of medicines as a way to really change the paradigm of the way people die and how they might die. This is a little article that talks about frozen alive, bringing cardiac arrest patients back from the dead. And if you go on to read that, this cold relief, cooling has really arrived, and we do a ton of cooling, both patients and teaching it all along the East Coast. We have probably, for those of you who want to learn about it, we have a website that has hundreds of thousands of hits on how to actually do this. And you can read about how a cold heart can save your brain if you go to this popular science article. But there's a problem with cooling as well, and I want to take you directly to what I think that problem is and why we're working very hard for some solutions. And what it appears is that cooling is a very time-dependent issue, that preventing reperfusion injuries, very time-dependent, and our coolants right now are terrible. I mean, and an example would be there's really almost nothing that will cool a person down substantially in your home, in an ambulance. And even when you get to the emergency department, it's very unsatisfactory. So one of the things that we developed was something we call a slurry. This is like a slushy from 7-Eleven. It's colored green right here. And what happens is if you pour it through a funnel, the ice sticks here, the water goes through, and no ice particles will go into your patient. So the idea is to get tiny ice particles in a patient. This is a good slurry. It runs right through the funnel. Ice particles are rounded. We actually chemically and mechanically change the shape of ice. And we're now creating sort of slurry devices that we have some new prototypes for so that doctors can actually sort of just sort of push a button, and when you need a patient's temperature to come down, that temperature will just sort of go right down to where you want it to go to in a matter of minutes, not in, does anybody want to guess how long it really takes to cool a person down by just 3 degrees? Just so you know, the papers that come out would suggest that right now we're at about 8 hours for that transition. And that was just published like in last month's, okay, Circulation was 8 hours. So this brings me to sort of where we are today in science. And I think that the most visionary scientist, so what's the citation? The Princess Bride, thank you very much. So you've got Miracle Max here, and here's the dead hero, you know. And he says, you know, look, your friend is only mostly dead. And mostly dead is slightly alive. And that is essentially the most brilliant synopsis of what is known about saving people's lives that currently exists in the year 2010, that mostly dead is slightly alive, and we don't know any more than that. We don't know any more than Billy Crystal said right then. So let me take you now to try to prove that I'm not totally blowing smoke here. This is work done by Jerry Buckberg, and he actually did 30 minutes of complete brain ischemia. Now, just so you know, the brain is not supposed to be able to tolerate that. And he's got a surgical technique where he cuts off all the blood that goes to the brain of an animal, and then he reperfuses that animal. And he does it two ways, one with controlled reperfusion. And his controlled reperfusion is sort of his own cocktail. And he and I work together, and we're now repeating these experiments in whole animals. But this is what I do in the emergency room, which is uncontrolled reperfusion. Normal blood goes back in, right? That's what you get right now in every department in the world. That's what you get. And so if you do this after 30 minutes of the brain being without oxygen in the uncontrolled reperfusion, two deaths by herniation. I don't know for those of you who know, what that means, the brain actively swells and essentially swells so much in the skull that it simply herniates through the skull. It actually just starts to ooze out through the holes in the skull. Immediate death, and everything is terrible in those animals. And by comparison with controlled reperfusion using a cocktail, all animals survived in this experiment, and three with complete neuro recovery, and three have mild deficits, no seizures. And this is what should be an entirely lethal event. That is something that no animal should survive, and for the most part, no humans would survive. So we're sort of moving on that, and I just want to sort of suggest that the far future is this notion of controlled reperfusion cocktails added with a pump that will take care of both the mitochondria and death pathways and put that together. So here's what we're working on right now. We are in the process of shrinking down a heart-lung machine because I'm not going to be able to fit that big machine on an ambulance to something that's small. We'll work with our engineers to do that. We're working on a way that we could very rapidly establish cannulation. You got to get into a big artery and a big vein. But that's not really an overwhelming issue that we shouldn't be able to handle, and we're making progress on that. And once you have that sort of established, you can sort of safely restart the heart, safely re-allow mitochondria to work without producing death. And I'm still searching for a mitochondrial meter. So I'm going to wrap up. This is my last slide. And I want to just now suggest what some of the implications of this might be. Because we've got just a number of things that are going to be big issues with this. So some things to think about. Well, one thing, of course, is, well, we still haven't defined what this time window is. And I'm going to make the argument that we don't know what that time window is, certainly not now. And it might turn out that there's not actually a point of death. Now, for the philosophers in the room, that's kind of an interesting notion, that there may not be a point of death. I suspect that that's probably going to be true. What about transplants? Does anybody know anybody who's waiting for a liver, waiting for a kidney? This sort of technology that I'm using would allow essentially almost any person that gets hauled into an emergency department to be an absolutely perfect liver, kidney, lung donor. Now, I'm not saying that just to sort of brag here. The France, the country of France, purchased 150 life support machines, not to save people's lives, but to do exactly what I'm talking about right here, to actually be put on patients after they're pronounced dead, so that all of those, so they can take care of their transplant problem. Because in this country, we would solve our transplant problem in somewhere between 9 and 18 months. There would be no shortage of organs at all. Something to think about. What about the new technologies that we get out of this? That we're talking about mitochondrial sensors. Well, that might turn out to be a really important tool for physicians to have. I'm going to argue that it is, because I think that many of the diseases that we now face, and you've heard people talk about Alzheimer's, heard people talk about Parkinsonism, many of those are being traced because they involve death. They involve many of the dynamics of the mitochondria. There's this other disease that we haven't talked about. It's called cancer. You can't pick up a cancer journal without seeing mitochondrial physiology in it, because it's actually the loss of these mitochondrial mechanisms that, at least in some ways, all tied up with malignancy. You can imagine that when cells lose the ability to die, what do you begin to see? You see cancer. So some pretty exciting technology. What about the ethics of this? Who will get it? Who will not? How will we decide? How will we ration it? Some pretty significant questions. And fundamentally, what I think is really interesting is that we will sort of, it's sort of this definition of what exactly is life and what exactly is death. We know that death is not the absence of life. It's something quite different. And I think as we learn about that, it offers us the opportunity to sort of do something really marvelous. As the first speaker spoke about, I too believe that in a very general way, life is good. And fixing people so that they can live a long life is good. And likewise, I believe that there's a great opportunity that we can give people a second chance. That is that in the future, it will be a remarkable thing if you can die once or twice and get the opportunity to do things over again. So with that, I'd be happy to take your questions. Was that right? Go, okay, please.
Hi, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about how the interplay between the buildup of electrons and the resurgence of oxygen in mitochondria actually lead to the cell death.
So it's pretty simple. Electrons are very promiscuous. Like, you know, you got nothing on them, okay? they are really looking for, you know, simply a physics sort of thing. And what we really think happens is within the mitochondria, those electrons that normally are being passed through, they actually begin to sit okay? And at that point, they simply will leak out, okay? Because there's still plenty of molecular oxygen, and that produces the very first free radical called superoxide. So that's how, and I don't want to get into this biochemistry too much, is what I study a ton of, but superoxide is sort of the first free radical, and it's the first elevation in free radical genesis that begins, okay? And you can imagine that you got a lot of electrons, you got a lot of oxygen, you're going to have to deal with superoxide. Please.
Thank you. Hi. A fair amount of people in this room will be interested in cryonics.
Yes.
Have you studied either the preservation or resuscitation of, you know, not a few minutes, but a few years?
Not at
10
all.
10 years?
So,
not at all?
So, okay. So I have not, but what is really interesting about that is that there's no question that there are great possibilities for that, and that the sorts of things about death are going to determine whether that strategy will work, right? So that if you cool someone down, we know that that alone is not going to allow you to restore somebody to life. I mean, not all by itself, not yet, okay? So you're going to have another notion about it, and it's very much going to be tied up with the, if you will, the producing energy once again, right? And sort of that's exactly what this is about. So I look forward to seeing that field sort of be synergistic with some of what we're doing. Please.
I was wondering if you tried this in the ER yet, and if you've noticed any increase in survival of cardiac arrest calls.
So we actually are now beginning to put dead patients on cardiopulmonary bypass. Now, what I have to tell you is we're the first center in the United States to be doing it, but I have really excellent colleagues in Asia who are far, far ahead of us. You know that in the United States, we have lost much of our dominance in this area. And so my good friend Ken Nagao in Tokyo has done hundreds of patients. They actually have a network throughout Japan that is working on this, and he'll be presenting some of that work in Chicago in November. People in Taipei are working on it. People in Seoul are working on it. And there are some other scattered places around. But our initial results are very encouraging. We have taken 6 dead people. And by dead people, what I mean is not only do they not have a pulse, but we had sort of done sort of what we call the advanced cardiac life support. So we had sort of gotten to the end of that where it was time to... And we've plugged those patients into cardiopulmonary bypass, and we've tried, and we have a 50% survival rate out of those 6 patients right now. So we're looking forward to doing more. We're also simulating it in the animal lab, and I guess one of the things that I want to make the point is this is not stuff that is like 10 years down the road. This is stuff that is here just right now. And so we hope that we could do some more things just in the next few months.
One more question?
Please.
Hi, I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about your controlled reperfusion cocktail.
I'd be happy to. So one of the big things is there's a big burst of free radicals that actually seems to occur within the first seconds and minutes of uncontrolled reperfusion. And what we believe is that sets off a whole series of cascades. So it's multiple pathways. So the notion that in biology, doctors are always looking for the silver bullet, the one, it's just probably not going to work because we probably have 2 or 3 death pathways that are going off at the same time. So the things that we're doing are trying to right now get on top of a whole series of those. So it involves the filtering of white cells to cut down very activated white cells that will amplify the death signaling. We control calcium. So just so you know, if I were to deplete all of your calcium in the room, all of your hearts would stop. We actually do that in these patients, all right? And the reason that we do that is because calcium is the ion that seems to drive and amplify much of this activity. And so we do that, and we only do that for a very short period of time. We also add some magnesium, we throw in a bunch of antioxidants, we do a number of things so that the tissues do not become edematous, because that gets into sort of no reperfusion, there's sort of endothelial injury that takes place. And right now what we think is that there's going to be a whole series of those things that will be important. But I want to come back to your idea of a cocktail because we've already got one cocktail that we know works, and that is cooling. All right? And cooling is not a single thing. It is a cocktail. It does multiple biochemical sorts of alterations that all turn out to, as far as we know, they're like all protective. And so our very first cocktail is already here, okay? And we use it in emergency departments already, and it will be part of what we'll be doing with this. I thank you.
Thank you.